Wesley, welcome to the War Room.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, the book is American Whitelash, A Changing Nation and the Cost of Progress. Often say I love a provocative title. Why this title in this book now?
Well, so I too enjoy a provocative title. My first book was They Can't Kill Us All, and it was a book that was about the rise in Black Lives Matter. It was in quotation marks. It was from a protest time. And I thought that that captured the ethos of the ethos of those early protests. In this moment, as much as the first book was about kind of the rise in this protest movement, this book is about the rise in the white supremacist movement in the years since Barack Obama was elected president. And to be clear, what I'm talking about this, I'm not using the term white supremacy or white supremacist in a colloquial way, right? I'm actually mean avowed, proud racist, white supremacist groups, white nationalist groups, right? No one who would dispute the labeling. But writing and talking about how those groups are playing on the anxieties and the frustrations of a much bigger group of people, Americans writ large, white Americans writ large, to try to bring people into their ranks and to commit acts of violence, right? We're in a moment where we're seeing an increased amount of violence from these groups, an increased desperation from them, and it's costing people's lives in Buffalo and Charleston and Pittsburgh and El Paso and all over the place. And so what I wanted to do was, if we were going to be living through such a moment, I wanted to the extent possible capture some of the stories of the people who were victim to this kind of moment and to this movement and try to place them in some type of context. So that, because when these things happen, we all go, this is terrible. I can't believe it. Everyone of various politics, various backgrounds, like no one is excited when a Nazi shoots up a synagogue, right? Except for other Nazis, right? All of us believe, well, this is a terrible thing that has happened. But too often that conversation stops with, well, it's so terrible. And what were we supposed to do? And how could we fix it? And I guess there's hatred in the world. And then we kind of move on until the next one happens. And I wanted to try to be able to understand these acts of violence in a context, both a contemporary context, but then also in a historical context.
So, I'm understanding you would say something like that, just pick the KKK, self-avowed,
Sure.
purpose is right. And the concern or the thing that you're tapping into is that they are not the same as maybe Bob on 123 Main Street, who's just a white guy in suburbia. And but your concern is that what they're doing via propaganda, via their actions, et cetera, is not only impacting Bob and maybe playing to or putting him in a state of fear, but it's also having negative impacts, as you mentioned, when there's act of violence is committed. And so trying to weave that narrative and that nuance is important because propaganda in general plays a large part of society today. And it makes it very tough. And one of the things that the podcast that I'm gonna hit release on here in a minute, I was just listening back to it. And one of the big frustrations I have is in US policy, foreign policy, the perpetual dehumanizing of our enemies. Now it seems that now these conversations at home, we talk in terms almost as if they're a foreign combatant. And if you disagree with me, you're one of these or you're one of those. And it's very eerily similar to how we talk about the nations that we want to attack. We denigrate them, we make them almost subhuman so we can go attack them. And so that's a very important concern, is that we had to figure out how to elevate the speech to a respectful manner, to make sure that we're considering everyone humans, and then we can talk
Yes.
about the policy and the problems and where we're going to disagree.
Of course. Well, it's respectful to even just responsible, right? We think about so many of the issues in our moment, right? And real legitimate issues where good faith people can have disagreement, right? Immigration and how many people should be allowed to come in and under what circumstances should they be? How many refugees should we take from a certain conflict versus another conflict versus total? What happens when crime goes up? And what do we do about the fact that some neighborhoods are more violent than others? And how do we police them? And what do we, all these conversations, completely legitimate conversations to have in our democracy. And also where people could have good faith policy disagreements, right? Like where it does not mean if you do not believe this thing, you are a bad person, or if you don't believe this thing, you are a good person. However, what we see so often in our mainstream politics is a demagoguing of these issues, playing on the fears, playing on the concerns, erasing the nuances of the complexities in ways that slowly and quickly make it so that these folks are dehumanized in our mind, and that plays to these movements of avowed racists who are sitting here waiting and are excited by the idea that our mainstream politics are dehumanizing all of these people of color who these groups believe shouldn't be here in the first place, right? And so we see this time and time again, and unfortunately too much of our political and our town square, right? That includes people in the media and our conversations, right? Everything becomes a political zero-sum game. Up, down, how do I scare you to vote for me versus that we use a rhetoric and a language that is so dehumanizing, and that becomes in some ways a gateway drug to even darker and more difficult ideas. I mean, people forget this, but Dylann Roof, the young shooter in Charleston, he becomes indoctrinated in part because he's watching coverage of the Trayvon Martin case, and he starts Googling white on or black on white crime statistics, and it leads him to white supremacist websites. And before long, he's writing a manifesto about the Jewish problem, and he's shooting up a black church. Right now, it is not that it's unreasonable for us to have a conversation about a case like Trayvon Martin, or for people to have different feelings or beliefs about it, for people to want to know and to grapple with ideas of crime and both intergroup crime and intragroup crime. But what we know that so often the rhetoric on this is so charged and so dehumanizing, so insensitive, and in many cases so irresponsible, that someone just Googling the words we say might lead them to very dark places. And we've seen that happen time and time again.
And the Dylann Roof thing is interesting because, to your point, there's a lot of things that get talked about. And one of the sad things that maybe got discussed and I missed was, is that here you have a church denomination that I think they split off from a more white denomination previously, but they never were able to reunite. And so here you have in 20, was that 2016? I don't remember what it was. You kind of have, in 2016, you still have this split to where for reasons that would make more sense, you know, back when they split, and there was never that ability to even reconcile those groups moving forward. And so it's kind of a stark reminder that even though there are people who are working to do stuff, there's still some sit downs that kind of need to happen to say, hey, you know, we broke off back in the 50s, the 60s, the 30s, or you know, whatever. Can we mend that fence? And that was kind of a, for me, when that happens, like, man, that never got done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that we live in a society where, you know, the thing about trying to be in a multicultural and multiracial democracy is that we're a country, you know, we are a country that's 50 different countries stapled together. And inside each of those 50, there are different communities and regions and spaces and cultures. And the thing about diversity and integration is that there's a natural tension. You're taking different things and you're mixing them together, right? That happens. It's real, you know. And one of the things I think for us is for us to be successful in the experiment of American multiracial democracy, we have to, our institutions, our society, our politics has to serve to soothe those tensions as opposed to exploit those tensions, right? Now, to be clear, that's not to say that we don't talk about difficult things or that we don't say a thing because it might upset people or that's not what I mean, right? But as you were noting, the level of just dehumanization and the level of making true enemies of political opponents, right? All of these things, and especially when we start talking about the demonization of specific groups of people, whether that's people who are coming over the border, whether it's people who live in a place that's different than ours or a city, we know historically, we've seen time and time again, how that level of dehumanization almost always leads to some level of violence.
And so this book is tied to politics. In the undertone of, or is it so far as tied to politics? And I think that when I think of the immigration debate or some of these debates, it seems that, to what you said earlier, we're never really having the conversation, because immigration is a very tough thing to think through. Mm-hmm. It's the number thing is almost secondary, in my opinion. There's other constitutional rights that could be given. There's all these things, and you know, I think so. It's ultimately down to voting, it seems, right? Voting. I mean, there's some talk about jobs, but I don't think that's in a lot of minds. Maybe it is. But voting is a big concern, it seems, when you talk about this. And so it goes to power. And we've centralized the power right and left to D.C. And it seems we've kind of forced ourselves into this trap to where every 4 years, it's about to start up here in just a few months, you know, Joe Biden or Trump or DeSantis, one of, you know, whoever the Republican is, one of those will ruin the country. There will be blood in the streets. And the other one will save the country, despite the fact I'm 38 in about a month. I've been through a lot of presidents. So, you know, not as many as some other people, but I've been through a few. They're all pretty mediocre in my book, some worse than others, but I don't think any of them are just the great white savior, the great white horse or none of that stuff. But that's what we're going to talk about. And we're going to have this rhetoric. And so we push, well, if you think this, then you have to vote for this person because they're going to do it. And then we forget time and again, most of these people let us down on the promises anyways.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that, you know, to go back to your point kind of about how some of this isn't even about numbers, but it's about power. It's about voting. It's about coalitions, right? And I would push that even a step further, that it's about who is an American. Mm-hmm. You know, who do we, and I don't mean that in a technical sense, right? Obviously the people who are, you know, but I mean that many folks are here because their parents showed up and we can say what we want about them doing it the right way or following the rules. A lot of them didn't, right? Or the rules were just different. There was a time when you could just show up and walk, you know, you end up in a territory before it's right. And so there was an opportunity. This was a land of opportunity for a lot of people who came here by a lot of different means across the border from the north, from the south, coming in from the west or from the east, right? And there's a question now of, okay, now that we've got here, at what there's this debate about, all right, how many more people should we let up the ladder or should we pull it up, right? Have we hit our, you know, and look, and there's always been there's for a very long time always been in American history a racialized component to this. And that's been different, right? The Irish and the Italians were considered black and brown back then, right? They were not pure red enough. And so we didn't like them and we discriminated. I mean, we obviously saw this when we started seeing Asian American immigration, the Chinese Exclusion Act, and the Japanese, right? And we know, we saw this when Jewish people were coming over as well in the early 1900s, right? And now we know that that a bulk of our immigration is coming from Central and South America. There are people who, there are obvious physical appearance differences, right? It seems like another group that is different. They're speaking a different language very often. There's some different cultural things, right? And so it's easy to see, one, how that conversation debate would be perceived as racialized very quickly, and two, how it could be racial, how the average person might feel more threatened by a bunch of people who look different than them showing up versus if they all kind of looked the same as you or spoke the same language or had to. And so I think all of those things, I think at the core, we're having a debate, a conversation about who is an American? Who has a claim to our freedoms? Who has the claim to be in our communities and be our residents and have the benefits of being one of us? And have we hit our capacity? And should we pull the ladder up and close the door? Or should it remain an open flow in that way, even if that means the demographics of our nation are going to change, that the average American is going to be a different person today than 50 years ago, and that 50 years from now, they might be different. And I think that question is very unsettled. And I actually think it's one of our real fault lines in our politics. People don't necessarily talk about it in those terms. But a lot of times, I think that's what the debate is about, is who gets to be an American and who will get to be an American looking forward.
Yeah. And so when you're saying that, I was thinking of trying to think of an analogy. And so if I live in a county that's got 60,000 people, the city proper has 13,000, whatever, something like that. And I was thinking, okay, well, what if 30,000 people from North Korea moved here in the city square, in the property? I would be concerned about the policies that they might vote in. Just because I know North Korean policies, I don't think I've ever been away from North Korea, but I'm aware of how their government works. And so there's a proper concern for me to have. Ooh, they might want to really have a regime very similar to what they're used to. That might be how they feel comfortable. And there's no racial component at that level. It's just practically that's their government. That's their government. But not being North Korea, I'm sure there are cultural things that they would do that are different than what people here would do. And so there's different layers. And on some level, we have to be careful because we want to try to keep them in their own bucket. But how? But also at the same time, they're all kind of connected too. And so it makes it very, very tough because you want to have the conversation and you want to try to be fair and to be honest and try to think through it. But you can't separate, you can't put them all together and you can't separate them all at the same time.
Exactly. There's an overlap, right? And it just, it's very hard to unweave in our mind and our perception. Well, okay, am I uncomfortable? How much of this is my legitimate belief? How much of this might just be a more base that I want to check for, right? Because we all have prejudices and we check them, right? We know that we do that, right? It's and trying to sort out those things where one becomes the other, what the interplay or, and I don't know that you can partition them out that way. I think all we can do, I think the best we can do is try to be aware. Mm-hmm. All right. How do I grade this on a curve a little bit? I might be inclined to, you know, feel a little extra negative. So how do I make sure to try to give this person the benefit of the doubt or to really hear this or to, and so I think there's some of that, but it is hard, right? And there's also unquestionably in every society, in our society, a defensiveness. We don't want to think of ourselves as being unfair to other people, or we don't want, you know, and so I think sometimes I think all of us, you know, if we're behaving in a way that's 5% prejudice, want to insist it's 0%, right? Like even if it's just the five, sometimes we have a hard, and we understand that, right? That we very often, I think it was George W. Bush who used to say that we see the best version of ourselves and the worst version of everyone else, right? Like, you know, and there can be a tension between those two things very often. That obviously doesn't just apply here. I think it applies in a lot of different contexts.
Yeah, yeah, no, and so the fear is, on one hand, to have a legitimate political concern.
Mm-hmm.
To your point, what is an American, and what does it mean? What does democracy mean, and all this stuff? You know, the people say if you vote for so and so, the democracy's at risk. It's like, well, I thought voting was part of democracy. You know, unless you're saying that.
Yeah, well, and it's a question about and what is our democracy and how do we define it, right? And how representative is it? How direct is it? Who gets to participate under what? And those are things that have always been negotiations and fights that have changed over time, right? What our democracy looks like and the extent to which we have a full democracy, really. And again, I use the term a lot. I talk about multiracial democracy to remind ourselves that is still relatively new in our, you know, in our history, right? And I don't mean that in a even necessarily in a negative context or connotation, but just to remember that when we talk about democracy today, American democracy today, we're talking about something foundationally different than we were talking about 100 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. That there actually is that we occupy a different type of democracy than we once did, right? And that raises new challenges, new clashes, new. Sometimes those are battle lines, right? How much should it be that way versus how much? And I think that sometimes we don't appreciate how relatively new and so therefore how relatively fragile the current state of play is. And I think that that factors into a lot of our contemporary politics as well.
Yeah. And so I'm thinking about Trump's Make America Great Again.
Mm-hmm.
What I found interesting about that statement was if you go back and watch Democratic or Republican primaries from probably Bush forward, maybe further back, I don't know. They all would say the same thing. We're outsourcing our jobs. They're leaving our communities. We're making our people poor. We've got to bring the jobs back. We got to do this. We got to do that. We've got to reinstitute, you know, these things. And what they're all saying, Republicans and Democrats, is that there was a time where the job market was better than what it was now.
Mm-hmm.
And then Trump says, make America great again. And people go, Whoa. And for me, I understand some of the criticisms that were being laid about the claim, but also I'm like, he's on some level, he is saying what almost all politicians I've heard say before, which is we've got to bring jobs back. And he was really hard on China, talking about bringing jobs back. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that in that discussion, there's a way that you can say we want to bring jobs back and that's okay. And there's another way to say bring jobs back, and it has a different connotation to it. And then people play to the, well, at this era, was it really that good or not? And to me, that is part of this larger problem. I didn't vote for Trump at the time, just so you know.
Oh,
So I'm not some dyed in the wool Trump guy, but I'm just
no,
found
it's
it kind of
okay.
interesting. Just he's only saying on some level, you might say saying more, but on some level, he's only saying what every politician says, which is we got to bring jobs back, i.e., the job market was better than it is today. And I don't know of a president who is not calling back to a previous period where things were good moving forward. And so why is it that a slogan like that from Trump, you think, is so divisive? Before he won, obviously, so when he's
Sure,
running.
sure, 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 sure. You know, I think there are two components to it, and I think you make a really good point, right? That it is unquestionably true, right? That our politicians and our politics play to, you know, of every political stripe, play to the versions of ourselves and our history that we like to believe in our heads, one way or the other, right? Like we can start getting into the specifics of, well, was it that good or not? But part of running to be the mascot of a country involves playing the greatest hits of the country, right? Like, or how, or
Absolutely.
as you imagine them yourself, or as you imagine your would-be supporters imagine them,
Every
right?
July 4th, I post a back-to-back World War champ meme on my Twitter feed.
Sure, right? You know, of course, like that. So
First to
there's
the moon, all that stuff. So yeah, of course,
there's a level of patriotism that's going to be factored into
sure,
running to be the president of the United States, right?
exactly.
Like that level of patriotism may or may not pass the full fact check one way or the other, right?
Of
Like
course, of course.
the elections, unfortunately, not won by nuance, right? But I think there were two things, right? And I think they're related, right? There's not actually a clean 1-2. I think they come together, right? And it was very hard to hear what Trump said. And you're right, much of what he was talking about was about jobs, access to manufacturing, about trade, about China, there was this idea of, in the way our economy and our country worked and operated, there was one we were once the winners and now we're not in the same way, right? That was very core to the Trump message, right? What was hard, though, is that, and I think if that had just been it, I think that there is a neutrality with which you could take something like Make America Great Again, right? But Trump, though, it's similar to, as we were talking about, like different motivations an individual might have or others, I think it's almost impossible to separate that from much of his other rhetoric, right? That part of implicit in the ideology of his campaign was that part of the reason America wasn't great again is because we didn't have a wall on the border and all these people were coming in, right? And then I'm going to shut down the flights from these Muslim countries. Making America great again involves and requires the exclusion of a bunch of different people who I'm going to disparage now, right?
Right.
And there's a real, and I get to the second part, where I'd say is that what's also true is that most of our politicians, this is maybe a little less true today. I think we see a lot of, I think there more people are following more of a Trumpian playbook now than perhaps
Oh
previously,
yeah, there's no
you
doubt.
know,
Even in local
and
Texas elections, you see people trying to be Trump. You're like, it doesn't work.
it
You're
is not the same thing,
Democratic.
and you're not as good at it.
Stop.
You're not good, exactly, right? But I think that some of the things he said, I mean, so I think, for example, about the line from the inauguration, first inaugur the inauguration, you know, American carnage, right? Like this idea that, like, that very often that our politicians most often sell us a version of our country that we want to, as we want to believe it is, right? Barack Obama was selling you a, we are capable of overcoming all of our history and we can fundamentally change things to be good and they don't have to be. And Donald Trump was like, there's carnage in the streets. Everything is terrible. And that is like, and I alone can fix it, right? But it wasn't in a way, I think, I'm sure there are likely some other examples. I don't want to suggest that Trump is the only one, right? But to me, that felt like a divergence from the average major party presidential candidate who is almost always suggesting, not that there aren't problems or things they want to fix, or not that there aren't things they would like to return to, but the fundamental appeal is to like American goodness and greatness. And you guys are so good, and that's why we are going to do it, right? Not everything's gone to hell, and unless you elect me, it's never going to
Right.
get fixed, right? That it'd be very hard to imagine such words coming from either the President's Bush or from Clinton or Obama or from, you know, whoever like from Reagan or Kennedy, right?
Right.
It's just a very different tonal idea. that is more cynical, is dispositionally more negative, whether it's effective or not, just is that way. And so because of that, his statements and his appeals to history, again, it's just so, and I think Trump does a good job very often of providing both the subtext, but then also not all the way saying it creates a space where sometimes there's a plausible deniability there, where you can hear in it what you want to hear in it, but you can say, oh, that's it. Well, if you look at the sentence, he didn't actually say, and I get why different viewers hearing it. Some would say this feels innocuous to me, and others would say this is deeply offensive. Right? I
And
can understand.
he also talks so dang much that there is just a quote for everything. Like
That's also
I do
true.
five podcasts a week. I hear myself talk. I'm like, I should talk less. I should talk a lot less because you just say a lot of stuff and you're going to sound stupid. But to your point,
Course.
I think a good example, and I want to go back to Obama in a second because I'm curious about your thoughts on this theory. But George Floyd, when that happened, and that the listeners don't go fact check me, I'm not trying to be exactly precise, but I believe, if I remember correctly, Trump reached out to Floyd's family like on Thursday or Friday, and he had spoken to maybe the brother or the mother. I can't remember. But there was
Sure.
something about him talking to them. And you're like, okay. Yeah, I appreciate that. Like that's a step in the right direction. And then that Friday night or Saturday night or whatever it was is when they had the protest outside the White House. And then he's tweeting out, sending the dogs and all this stuff.
Yeah, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, and
Yeah.
the
And for me, it was the because I talked to some of my Republican friends who are like, oh man, he's too much and da da da. I said, you know what's crazy is he actually reached out to Floyd's family. Why does he not just pump the brakes and say, hey, folks outside the gate, I know you're bad. Oh, by the way, I did talk to to George Floyd's family. I want to have them in. I want to see what happens. I just, but listen, I get the frustration. But to your point about hearing what you want, if you want to focus on him talking to Floyd's family on Friday, you can. If you want to ignore that and talk about what he said on Friday night or Saturday night, whatever it is, you can. And there is this weird situation to where he does something that's very admirable on one hand, it seems. And on the other hand, it's like, you've lost your mind. What are you doing?
Exactly. And it just becomes this, and we just experience it. We experience it over and over again, where even in these moments, and some of this is dispositional. It's not even pure politics, right? It's that there are things we just know about this man, right? He's been in the public eye for a very long time, right? Dispositionally, he's not necessarily the calmest or the most reasonable or the most level-headed. If there's a fight at my home, I'm not going to call Donald Trump to mediate it, right? It's not a
Right,
right.
right.
So and so,
To promote it, maybe, but not to
sure,
mediate.
correct, right? Like, think about it, right? And so here we have the latest chapter and latest episode in one of the most tense historical tug of wars in our nation's history. One of the chief foundational tensions is our legacy of slavery and how we figure out how much of it's still impacting our lives today and what we do about the disparities that are left behind and how much of it's interpersonal and how much of it's structural and how much and are people overstating it, right? That's the debate and that's the push and pull. And now Donald Trump has a seat at the table in helping moderate the conversation, right? And so it's a very interesting, again, there's something that about him that's just dispositionally different, right? Say what you will about whether it be Barack Obama's politics or George W. Bush's politics, right? Just to use our two, or Biden and what to use our two most recent examples, right? All of them are much closer dispositionally in how they would handle such a
Absolutely.
thing. Donald Trump is so different than that, right? In a way that is just night and day. The reality is the Bush statement versus the Clinton statement versus the Obama statement. All
It's
those would have
all the
been
same.
probably pretty close to the same thing, right? And then you've got when the looting starts, the shooting starts, sending the dogs, right? And so I think that's a big part of it too, is that not even getting into the political differences and not even getting into what he might believe or not believe personally, the way he behaves, and I don't mean that as a charge, the way he behaves is just so different than any other president we have had.
Okay, so here's my harebrained thesis. So I'm not sure I'm dying on this hill, but as we're talking, thinking through this, if we go back to the Obama administration, no fault to Obama, he becomes president really during the true internet age. I mean, Bush was around, but you know, social media and all that stuff is really getting its legs under the Obama administration. And so if you think of it, I remember the Michael Brown incident. You mentioned Black Lives Matter earlier. And I remember getting on Facebook and people saying, you know, Black Lives Matter or Back the Blue. And I was like, well, what happened? I mean, I know what happened practically, but what actually happened? I hadn't seen a video. And that's one of those moments where you kind of realize that people are doubling down before they have evidence. And politicians are doubling down before they have evidence. And the only thing that's really different is now the story can be kept alive on the internet to where you can see, oh, person A is wrong about this. Person B is wrong about this. Why isn't the media talking about this? Why not this? And so under Obama's administration, the ability to talk about Fast and Furious or the drone strikes that killed Americans was able to be created and had at a level that it wasn't under previous presidents. And you begin to see that maybe everything we're being told is not really being reported like it should be. And again, this is more, this is more because it's Obama's. Obama just happened to be president during this era. It'd be anybody.
Exactly.
I'm not trying to pick on him particularly. And so as his presidency progresses, you begin to watch. I remember thinking under Obama, wow, these guys are really bad. And then Trump came in. I was like, wow, they're really bad. And then Biden came in. I was like, wow, they're even worse than I thought. Because now there's, you can follow the story without having to turn on one of the big three networks and, you know, sit back and relax and go, let me look at this and see what's going on. And so it feels like Obama and his presidency was caught in the, to your point, a Bush, a Clinton, a Bush, a, you know, he's in that era. Trump is reactionary to that because now he's on Twitter talking about birth certificates and all this stuff. Yeah, he can talk about stuff and people were talking about it. And then when he gets in, you do see some good journalism done and you see a lot of bad journalism done. And so people can sit back and go, And so now as we move forward into the Biden and whoever's next, it feels like on some level, the old way that we did politics is trying to figure out how to do it in the new way. To your point, there's a lot of people who act like Trump. That doesn't really work. It's not really helpful. And instead of people going, you know what? Yeah, JFK was sneaking girls in all the time and we knew it. We didn't tell nothing about it. And Clinton did this and Bush did this and Reagan did this. And we all covered it up. Let's try to just do our jobs better. We start trying to defend our guy or gal because we really don't want to talk about all these things. And it creates this tension where I can look. People, I talk about people being red-pilled. They're red-pilled. They see the world differently. And then they protect people who are doing things wrong that they just flop sides on.
Yeah, right? Of their tribe, right?
Of their tribe. Right.
You're on my team. Everything becomes a zero sum. But I think you identify a really smart point though, and I think it does really matter, right? I actually think like two different things are true, right? I actually think, and I'll put this stake down, and then I'll critique my own point. But I actually think we probably have the best journalism we've ever had, right? Mm-hmm. Like, actually, in terms of there are, and now I'm not a nostalgic person who actually thinks it was much better previously, right? Like, that's as much a comment about about a more mm-hmm. objective view of what the journalism previously was,
right?
To where today we do have a much more democratic press in mm-hmm. that right now you and I are having a conversation, right? And we don't have to be an oil baron who purchases a newspaper and be of the right, you know, that the public square is so much more democratic than it ever has been. I mean, that small d democratic, right? More people can participate. Mm-hmm. More people can show us what's going on in their lives and they can get people to be responsive. They can force mainstream media to pay attention to stories they care about that they might not have cared about. I think that's good, right? But what I also think is true, and I think part of this is, you know, we see this in our institutions, not just the press, but all of them, right? Is that there's more transparency and there's more insight. They're less mythical, right? We can see the space between the men and the marketing in a way that we couldn't before,
right?
Well, the church says the priests are good, so they are, right? Well, now we can see it in a way that is different, right? And I think I think we have a more honest understanding of the faults and the quality. We don't have to wait 20 years to realize that everyone got this big story wrong. We see it immediately. People can point it out. They can, and because of that, there's a requisite drop in trust, right? That I'm not actually sure the press is any worse than it's ever been. I think would argue the other way. I actually think it's probably on whole better than it was previously, right? But we now have a more, we can x-ray the problems in ways we couldn't see before. We can see it in a way we might not have seen before. I think that becomes really, really difficult. I think that we also, I think the press also, you know, I think we have not served ourselves well with our failure sometimes to see and recognize nuances, right? To just say what we don't know, to be more conversational and less voice of God, right? Because if I'm saying, hey, look, I've reviewed the evidence I got so far, and I talked to these people, and here's what I think it's true, but I'm obviously going to keep doing work. That's very different than me looking at you in news anchor voice and saying, what happened yesterday is X, Y, and Z, right? And the problem is, sometimes we really only have strong enough to do the first thing, a more caveated, nuanced, let me acknowledge what I don't know. Let me, you know, like it could mean this. It could also not. Give me some. And we just dispositionally very often don't have the ability to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we come out saying things in these definitive ways that then end up not being true. And if I tell you something and then it's not true, that's going to harm your, you're going to not trust me as much the next time, even if it's completely reasonable in terms of just how the press operates, right? Mm-hmm. That, well, this is what we knew at 7 p.m. and now at 9 we update it. A lot of that is, I mean, and this isn't political, ideological. A lot of it's just like technological. We, our newspapers and our broadcast stations were built from a time where you could only update on a regular, right? Like, you know, like, so you write what you know to be true on Monday and on Tuesday, then you write what you know to be true. And so it's kind of okay that it might change drastically between them. Because those are the updates, right? Well, today we live in a 24/7 all the time on social media. Like, so this idea that you would write a sentence and then it ends up not being true, and or it would have given you the wrong impression, people have way less patience for that, which I think is appropriate, right? And beyond that, because what's also true is the ability for something to travel around the world in an instant is different. The ability for the initial error to spread far and wide, it wasn't the same thing in the early 1900s when you printed something in Monday's newspaper and they were literally by horseback taking them to all the output. You know, it just there's a much higher consequence to getting something wrong today, or could for the person who is being written about, or for the politician, or for the, and so I get all that and I see all that, and I think that there's a real, you know, I do think that we, you know, I think we have to endeavor and strive to do better. And it was, it's also hard because we're also here at a time where the industry is going through these massive contractions. The internet's changed how everything works. You know, we're also not the strongest strength we've been at as an industry at a time where now the expectations have changed, I think, for the better, where people have more insight into how we screw up and when we screw up. And there's one of me instead of five of me when there used to be five, right? And it, And so I think we see some errors because of that too.
Well, and you take an issue that's controversial, and there's a fear of nuance. And so if you take something like January 6th, it was weird when Tucker Carlson released some of the video. And I was like, okay, there's a gazillion more videos to release. I don't have people walked in there that day. And I don't have an opinion on what they all did. I have kind of some general buckets of what some of them did. Some of them just walked in there, and some of them were like absolutely crazy. And there's a spectrum in between. But it was weird to watch the media kind of like chastise, like, what are we doing here? And it's like, wait, I thought that was the job. I thought that was the job to give me all of the facts so you could help me understand the story. And a current example that I've seen play out is this LIV Golf PGA deal. Have you been following that?
I've been following it a little bit. So I don't have expertise, but that might be a good one to talk about.
Yeah. And so the LIV Golf is backed by the Saudi National Wealth Fund. And they've been criticized extensively, PGA players, for going over there. And as soon as they left, it's PGA magically found more money to pay the players. magically. And now they've merged after the PGA has just blasted the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund over and over and over again for being, you know, all these terrible things. And I was watching a CNN host talk to one of the golfers, and I was like, you know, what's interesting is, you know, the U.S. has helped the Saudis bomb people in Yemen for a long time. I don't, I don't hear that talked about quite often. That, you know, I mean, I hear that, you know, that's gone on under several administrations. We sell them weapons. And I'm not trying to say we should be pro or anti-Saudi, but it's weird to watch if you know a little bit about geopolitics and how the world works. We're all funding the Saudis because we're driving cars and, you know, we're all tied up in that. And it's weird that, this is the issue. We want to make the Saudis the bad guys over here. But they invest in all a lot of big corporations. The U.S. has, you know, military allegiances with them. So it's one of those things to where you find the media will grip onto a narrative and they'll pound it home. And you're like, why are we not doing that in D.C. or to someone else? Like, why are you not going to companies who are taking their money as stock investors and saying, call them, tell them, take their money home? It's a very selective outrage, is I guess what I'm getting at.
Yeah, no, and I
And
think you've.
that's,
I was
I'm
gonna
saying
say, I think.
it's far more easy to see that nowadays, and that erodes the trust.
Yes, well, because it feels and in many cases is an inconsistency, right? That it's not. The argument is not that it's unfair to ask these golfers or the PGA about this. It's this question of okay, but why on this one does this matter so much, and why not in these other places, right? And I think that that's. I think that's extremely consistent. I think that's extremely fair, right? I think that there's a world where if we create standards or we decide we're going to be upset about something or something matters, or that I think there should be some consistency with it, right? And we should be willing to ask, we should be willing to ask really hard questions of people who we may be inclined to agree with, and we should be willing to try to hear the good, the better version of the person who we're inclined to, right? And I do think people get upset rightfully when they feel as if we are picking and choosing our targets in ways that are calibrated to some greater end, right? Now, I don't necessarily, I'm not sure that the media would be capable of conspiracy if we wanted to be, because I know us, right? I assure folks when they talk, I promise you, there was no plan, because we couldn't make one. But I totally understand and get why so many people. Sometimes when they see this, again, they're not asking for these questions not to be asked in this context. They're saying, but aren't there other, if this is a thing we really care about, shouldn't we be more consistently covering and talking about Saudi influence and interest peddling and X, Y, and Z, right? Not just in this case, in this particular area. And I think that's completely fair. I think it's completely valid, right? Because in a lot of ways, it's an argument. While it is framed as a critique of journalism, in some ways could be framed as an argument that is a call for more journalism, right? That you're not consistently doing the thing that you say that you guys want to do.
It's a call for more journalism, and it goes back to your point in the book, which is there will be groups with voices, and they intentionally, unintentionally, whatever it is, will get a message out that will resonate larger than to their group. And oh, by the way, that's normal because there's a lot of things people agree on that even on opposing sides, right? So if you just start talking a lot, you're going to say things like, oh, yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, whatever I think about your other politics. And so what happens is, the level of perceived, that's the word here, perceived integrity that you have to have becomes lower because you can look at other sources who claim to have high integrity and you can dismantle it in 30 seconds. And once you dismantle that, you go looking for perceived integrity somewhere else, and then you find that, and now you've, oof, this is my guy, my gal, my news source. And so CNN or Fox, whoever it was who had it, they lost it, and they lost it because they just won't try to shoot it, you know, they won't just try to take a deep breath and go, And so when you're talking about this, your thesis for the book, I can see how this can play out because there is a lot of distrust towards the media, towards the politicians, and the response that doesn't seem to have been, let us do a little bit of self-reflection. It seems to be, let's double down, let's alienate, let's go rally our base more. And that pushes people to go look for other sources.
When there are more sources now than ever before,
There's
right?
also more
And
sources too.
I think that's a big part of it too. The reality is the market shares is totally different. We're not in a world where we're all watching the same four channels anymore, right? There was something I saw this somewhere, and I might get the. I know you've got really astute and studious listeners, and so I might get the specific numbers wrong here. But I was reading somewhere they were talking about the idea that. In the diffuse journalistic marketplace or media marketplace, how So like Joe Rogan has the most listened to podcast in the country, but only 5% of people who have a favorite podcast, he is their favorite podcast, right? So like, so you are the leader in the industry and you're reaching almost no one. You're in the margin of error, right? Like it's the, like, and you are the biggest. Right. And so it speaks to how we're getting our information from these completely different places that are hyper-personalized, they're hyper-tailored to us. I mean, we end up living in a world where we rarely have to encounter things we are disposed to disagree with because we can curate our lives. And even those of us who want to, right, still end up curating our sources of information in ways that reinforce things we already believe or reinforce the groups we're already members of. And so it's very interesting that way versus a world where there were many fewer options, right? It's the other side of that democratizing of the news, where now there's so many more options, so many more voices, so many places to get information and analysis and news, but the spectrum of them, not just politically, but in terms of quality and accuracy and factual, like, is just all over the place, right? And that, and we have to figure out, I think that we have to find, I think about this a lot, like the health of our information news ecosystem and what does it mean for us to find and reestablish some trusted sources. Now, that's not to say that, I mean, I'm not someone who believes that any of our sources are unbiased. I think there are always biases that would be baked in one direction or the other. And I would argue we should be more transparent about them or more, or just more dispositionally humble, right? Like, hey, to me, it seems like this is what happened, but I'm going to leave the door open that maybe it didn't, right? And, you know, and so it's a, what does it look like for us to build that again or build that in some way? Because again, I'm not someone who necessarily believes there was a good old days. It probably didn't exist the way we'd like to think it did, right? But what does that look like? And can we do it at a time where, and how do we put a premium on places that, okay, I know they're going to be rigorous. I know they're going to try to be fair if they don't always get it right. I know they're going to try to be humble. And how can we get our news organizations to look and feel like that?
Yeah.
So that at the very least we can say, all right, let's go to the same place, let's watch the same show, and then we can debate about it, right? That's what's hard so often, is that we're not even looking or living at the same world, and then we're trying to have a debate in different languages about it.
That's right.
And that's not working very well.
Yeah, we're not launching from the same spot. Exactly. That's a big problem. And I think maybe I know I was a kid when this happened, but the O.J. Simpson trial, I think, was probably maybe one of those times in history where you heard people talk about, I'm from Louisiana originally, live in Texas now, you know, I mean, I was in third, fourth grade probably when this happened. Fascinated by the trial, just, you know, kind of a big thing as a kid.
Oh yeah.
But, you know, you hear the verdict and you hear the jurors talk about, and people from that community talk about police brutality and all this stuff. And, you know, California is a long way from Louisiana, you know, and you're like, huh, really? The cops I know are all nice. Well, you know, I can't imagine this is a thing. The launch point was different. I'm not trying to get into whether OJ should have been guilty or not.
Sure.
The launch point of the conversation is different. And the problem was and is, on some level, is that what was happening in those communities was not getting the proper attention it should have been. And so you can't even have a conversation because the world that these people were living in, which, oh, by the way, it's not all cops that were bad. There's crime going on, too. Like, you know, it's a nuanced conversation. But that world's not even being exposed to most Americans. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, I don't know what you're talking about. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is my experience. Well, and beyond that, I think that we are uniquely, I think as humans, we are uniquely poor at recognizing that our experiences are not necessarily other people's experiences. Like, the world as we experience the world maybe our objective reality, but is not the objective reality, right? And that's not me arguing there isn't objective, you know, but what I mean is that we all have very different experiences, right? I come on and I go, oh, Ryan's really nice. And your brother's like, no, Ryan,
he's a jerk.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Like, and it's not that I'm right and he is wrong, or it's that we may have completely different experiences with the same person or the same thing. Both of which can be true, right? Yeah. But we end up in this, but now we're going to have a big fight about, is Ryan a jerk or not?
Yeah.
Ryan's a jerk.
We'll just go ahead and say it now. I'll take the jerk.
Right? You know, but like, and there's no room for any nuance or complication. It's right now, and your brother's going, well, I'm making it all up. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, well, that can't be true because of, right? And we're like, and we marshal our friends and our own evidence. right? So we can prove that we are emphatically right while this other person is wrong, right? Even though the world's more complicated than that, you know? And I think that I think that there's a huge part of that. I think we have a really hard time thinking like, oh, well, this is how I grew up, and this is what my life was like, and this is what my parents were like, and this is the school I went to. And that it, in some ways, we just assume that our experience is kind of a standardized experience, even though that as we get older, we know more people, we talk to folks. I'm in a fortunate position. I get to travel the country and talk to people for my job. I know that there's the spectrum of experiences on all of those things is so wide that I could never imagine that I know anything about someone else's life until I really sit down and start talking to them.
And the problem we now have is, if there were an O.J. Simpson like incident today, you could get on Twitter. Within a few in YouTube, within a few hours, you could go and look at some snapshots and interviews of people in the community, and you could get a better flavor of what's going on. But it's still just a snapshot and a taste. It's not the real thing. And so we then perceive to have more knowledge than we have, and then we talk about
Yes.
things that we so it's better to your point, but there's still it's like we still need to be a little bit more humble. Go yeah. Okay, I can see what's going on here. There's a problem. Okay, that makes sense. But I know 1%, 99%, I still don't understand.
Exactly. And there's a need for I think that sometimes, you know, the internet, social media, cable news, I mean, a lot of our media writ large, right? And, you know, it's not like the internet created this problem. It's not but like our town square writ large, it rewards surety. It rewards the person who says, this is what happened, and those people are lying to you, and this is what it is. And they're the good guys, or we're the good guys, and those people are the bad guys. And this, and again, the reality just requires a different level of humility. That's not to say that there are not facts, there are not things that are true and are not true, and that there's not an importance to cling to those, even if they become unpopular, right? But it is true that there are nuances and complications to a lot of stories in ways that are not always reflected, or are they're not necessarily always rewarded. They're not the people who people flock to in that same way, right? That our media can only be as media is an institution of our country, right? And our country is an institution of our citizens. Like our media is only as healthy as our citizenry is. And because we reward with our pocketbooks, with our viewership, with our listens, we reward the media we want and that we don't want.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Speaking of reward, let's send people to buy your book, American Whitelash, A Changing Nation and the Cost of Progress. We're also going to link to your website and your Twitter. Is there anywhere else you want us to send people to?
No, I think that's the main stuff. And, you know, as I hope folks will notice from our conversation, I mean, I enjoy talking about this stuff, right? I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's important. You know, it's why I have a job where I get to talk to different types of people all the time. And so, you know, people can feel free to send me a message and tell me they think I'm full of it and I got the whole book wrong. I'm fine. And I'll ignore my friends and family to respond to you because that's how I am, right? You know, but I mean it when I say I think there's a lot that can be gained from being willing to talk to each other in ways that we're not always willing to talk to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, thank you so much for your time today, and best of luck on the book.
Ryan, thank you so much, man. I'll talk to you soon.